Those of you who have been following me for some time know that I've been thinking a lot about the experience of men in today's society. I worry that traditional expectations of masculinity are undermining men's mental health and making it harder for everyone to achieve more psychologically safe, inclusive workplaces. This week, I'm sharing an incredibly powerful and important conversation with Mike Cameron, leadership coach and author of the book, Becoming a Better Man. When something's gotta change, maybe it's you. Trigger warning for those of you who are sensitive to discussions about domestic violence. Here, Mike shares his personal journey from financial entrepreneur to coaching men to improve their mental health by becoming more emotionally connected, which began with the murder of his girlfriend by her ex-boyfriend. Mike and I talk here about the ways in which the patriarchy negatively impacts men as well, and how we would all be better off if men were given the space and encouragement to connect with their feelings. As the mom of two young boys and the partner, friend, and family member of many men, I deeply believe in this mission. And I do so not at the expense of women or in an effort to undermine the experience of women. This is not an either-or proposition. I do this because we will never achieve our societal goals without healthier men by our side. Please help us spread this very important message by sharing this with the men in your lives. Thank you so much, as always, for listening. Welcome to the Imposter Syndrome Files. My name is Kim Menninger, and as an executive coach and former high-tech leader, my personal mission is to help professionals overcome imposter syndrome so that you can advance your career with confidence. Each week, I interview a new guest who brings a powerful perspective to this conversation, including personal stories, best practices, and new insights. The more we talk about this issue, the more we destigmatize imposter syndrome, recognize that we're not alone, and empower ourselves to access the tools and resources that can help us and those around us. Thank you so much for listening and for sharing with others you think would benefit from this conversation. Welcome, Mike. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while now. You and I had a chance to talk offline, and I can't wait to bring our conversation to the community. And I would love to start by inviting you to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. As you said, my name's Mike, and I have been an entrepreneur for the last 30 plus years. I started in finance, eventually started my own business, built that business over 16 years, and ultimately sold it in 2019 to focus on what it is I do now. I'm a leadership coach, certified executive coach, but more specifically, I work directly with men and their well-being. So, you know, I talk about emotional connection and its impact on peak performance, leadership, and probably more importantly, mental health. So that's what I do. I do a lot of keynotes in the mental health arena, as well as performance coaching.
So that obviously is a big shift from entrepreneurship and the financial space, right? So what motivated you to move in this direction?
Well, it's interesting because it's not as big of a shift as it sounds. And that was kind of a revelation for me. So yeah, my story, what led me to this space, you know, I think we all have those pivotal moments in life, those moments that ultimately change the course of the path that we thought we were on. And for me, that was October 2nd, 2015. On October 2nd, 2015, my girlfriend Colleen woke up at my place. Her alarm went off at 5 a.m. She was a yoga instructor, taught early mornings. So alarm went off at 5 a.m. She gets up, gets dressed, comes around to my side of the bed, gives me a kiss. I said, have fun at yoga. And I rolled over and went back to sleep, and off she went. I woke up at 7 o'clock, went downstairs. And as was our custom, I shot her a text and I said, hey, how was yoga? To which I got no response. And, you know, I didn't think too much of it at the time. She's not a huge talker, but she's an incredible listener, and as a result, would often get sucked into long, drawn-out conversations with students after yoga. So I didn't think much of it. Had my breakfast, got dressed, got ready, headed out the door to go to a meeting. Still hadn't heard from her, so I sent her another text. No response. As I got in the car, I picked up the phone. I called. Phone rang and rang and rang. Eventually went to voicemail. And, you know, now I'm starting to, like, get that little feeling like, okay, did I do something to make her mad? Am I in the doghouse? Is, you know, and then of course your mind starts doing those stories. Is she getting back together with her ex-husband? Is, you know, what's going, like, wait a minute. And then, you know, so you have to sort of settle yourself down. I went about my morning, had my meeting, went back to the office. I had another meeting. We wrapped that meeting up and I still hadn't heard from her. And by this time, you know, I've got that feeling in the pit of my stomach, just something is not right. And I could not focus at all. We end up going across the street to go for lunch. And as we walk into the restaurant with my clients, my phone rings and I look at it and it's a blocked number. And I answer the phone and the voice on the other end of the phone says, "Is this Mike Cameron?" I said, "Yes." He said, "This is Constable so-and-so." And my heart just sank. And I practically screamed into the phone. I said, "Is she okay?" And he says, "Where are you?" And I yelled again. I said, "Is she okay?" He says, "Where are you? We're at your house. We're coming to you." And so I told him where I was. I turned, I walked out of the restaurant and I stood at the curb for what felt like an eternity, but it was probably 5 or 6 minutes. My house was not far from where we were. And this unmarked police car pulls up across the street. And I start walking towards it. Cop gets out and starts walking towards me. And in the middle of the road, halfway across the street, he just looks me in the eye and he said 3 words to me that would change my life forever. He simply said, "Colleen is dead. Shot and killed by an ex-boyfriend who subsequently took his own life." And in that moment, you know, everything obviously shifted for me. And, you know, I was fortunate in that I had lots of friends and family and coworkers and colleagues. I had a large community around me that supported me. And, you know, most of them wanted me to go after the justice system because they know I'm a doer. I don't just sit back and let things happen. And so I had lots of folks talking about, you know, the justice system, which certainly let her down. You know, she'd done all the right things, filed the paperwork, had the restraining order, she'd filed the breach. But as we well know, you know, a piece of paper isn't going to stop a bullet. And when I looked at that question, I thought, you know, how do we build a better restraining order is probably the wrong question. And maybe a better question is, how do we prevent men from getting to that point in the first place? And so when I looked at sort of my skill set and bringing this back to sort of entrepreneurship, sales, leadership, I realized that, you know, over the course of years, I got invited to speak at conferences because I'd been fairly successful in business and in sales. And I always talked about the impact that emotion had on human behavior. So, you know, if you want to sell more widgets, you need to make that emotional connection with your customer. If you want to inspire your team to be a better leader, you need to make that emotional connection to your vision. So I talked about that in the context of sales and leadership for 20 some odd years. And what I realized was that this was the exact same thing, just a different context. I mean, this was a man that made a decision with very permanent consequences based on a very temporary emotion. And, you know, the more I sort of went down that road, the more I realized, again, and for us as men, you know, we're actively discouraged. We've had the emotions conditioned out of us. And if we don't understand the underlying emotions that drive the decisions we make, we're kind of fucked. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. I hope it's okay to swear on your podcast. If, I mean, you know, we're screwed. So, and again, that's a disadvantage us men have is that we're typically not really good at exploring that emotional side of self because we've been conditioned that that's weak. Mm-hmm. It's not strong. We need to remain strong. So that's the long version of, you know, how I ended up in that space and how, in fact, it's not as much of a leap from the sales leadership and business side of the equation as one might think it is. Because, and that really struck me. And I recognize that I choke up as I say this. Like, everything I've done my entire life has prepared me for this. Yeah, and it was such a powerful revelation. So, you know, again, I still come at it from the leadership performance side of the equation, because typically that's what guys respond to, right? We want to perform better. We want to show up in the world better. We don't necessarily want to talk about our emotions. So, you know, from a sales pitch standpoint, you know, that is the lens I come at it from, is how do we live a richer life? How do we perform better? How do we show up better? And most men want that. And the reality is that's through becoming more emotionally connected to self, to others, and community.
Well, I have so many different questions. I'm trying to figure out which one I want to ask you first, because I'm so glad you brought up the social conditioning piece. And this is something that is really near and dear to my heart, because I have two boys and I want them to be, you know, mentally and emotionally healthy when they go, as they continue to grow and go out into the world. And, you know, I had an experience recently where my younger son, who's 9 now, we were watching TV and it was an older show. And one of the boys said, like, "Oh, boys don't cry." And I saw hit the panic in his face. And he said, "That's not true, right? That's not true." Like, he heard it in this very almost threatening way. And I thought to myself, like, wow, this is not, I mean, not that I didn't know this already, but this is not something they're born into, right? This is something men are taught. And so I wonder, as you think about your own journey, like you were talking about, and you were, you know, really connecting around the importance of emotion, but did you have to do any inner work on your own to get to this point? Like, what was your relationship to emotions?
No, I was born emotionally connected. Well, that's a true statement. I mean, if you think of, you know, you've got kids, remember them as toddlers. Like, we're not born emotionally disconnected. If you've ever had a toddler, you know, because they can throw their little hissy fits. They are very adept at expressing emotions. And it is something that is conditioned out of us over time, and especially us men. So for me, and it was interesting, because when I first started having these conversations publicly and I first started talking about this, my mom reached out to me, and I think she was a little offended. And she said, "You know, we never raised you like that." And she's right. She didn't. Like, it was always a safe environment in our home. We were never raised with, you know, dad wasn't sort of the suck it up and don't be a pussy kind of fought. Like, he was never that way. And mom certainly wasn't. So, you know, within our home, the way I was raised, we were absolutely, you know, allowed to emote. But still, to your point, I mean, the media that we see, the pop culture, the movies, the television, all of the messaging is around that boys don't cry, suck it up, don't be weak. So for me, I mean, I absolutely fell into that category, and in such a big way. You know, my first foray into finance, I mean, that's a longer story, but I when I was 26 years old, I started doing fairly well financially in the finance space. And so I went and bought a Porsche. You know, as I said, I learned early in my sales career that we buy on emotion and we justify it with logic. I got to tell you, there is nothing logical about buying a Porsche that's 2 times your salary when you're 26 years old. It was all an emotional decision. And it was all because I wanted to show up and I needed to be a baller and I needed to, you know, if I was going to be successful, I justified it with all this bullshit logic. So absolutely, I needed to do a lot of that inner work, you know. And then as I went on and became more and more successful in business, that became my go-to. And as my ex-wife and I started to sort of drift apart, you know, she threw herself more into the kids. I threw myself into my work because that was my identity. And in fact, as I look back, you know, that was my coping mechanism. That was my numbing technique. You know, some folks jump to drugs or alcohol. I mean, workaholics, they're the respectable addicts, right? I'd get patted on the back for all the accomplishments. Yet the reality was all I was doing was numbing my emotions. And so to your question, did I have to do the work? I continue to do the work. And that was one of the really cool things that Colleen and I did together. We did a lot of that work together. I spent 3 years after my divorce just by myself doing some of the work. Then I met her. We did a lot of that work together. And, you know, when she was killed, that was again, another opportunity for me to do more of the work. And, you know, I certainly could have thrown myself back into my work, into the busyness, the business, and continued to go down that path and just numbed the shit out of myself. But for me, I realized, and it was actually a friend of mine sent me a letter to Rachel, written by a fellow by the name of Ram Dass. Ram Dass was an American spiritual leader in the 1970s. This letter to Rachel was a letter he wrote to the parents. Rachel was a young girl who had been murdered. He wrote this letter to her parents. And there were, I would highly recommend that your audience look it up. It's like five paragraphs long. It's not very long at all. Ram Dass' letter to Rachel. And in that letter, there were three big epiphanies for me. The first, he said, is anyone strong enough to remain conscious through such teachings as you are receiving? Probably very few. And what I realized in that moment was that I needed to stay open to the lessons. I needed to receive the gift that she had given me, the gift of a depth of feeling that many people will never experience. And again, don't get me wrong, it's not a gift that I would necessarily wish upon my worst enemy, but I couldn't change what had happened. So I recognized that I needed to remain conscious. I could not numb myself through this. The second piece in that letter, he said, our rational minds will never understand, but our hearts, if we keep them open, will find their own intuitive way. And I can't tell you how many times I asked that question. Why her? Why now? Why? And there's no rational answer for that. And what I realized was if all I did was ask that why question, it was just going to keep me stuck. It was like trying to move forward, paddling a rowboat. You're moving forward, but you're looking backwards. And I needed to flip that into a kayak where I'm facing forward and I'm paddling and I'm moving forward. So that kind of became a bit of a mantra for me, kayak, not rowboat. And the third and probably most powerful piece out of that letter was, he said, now is the time to let your grief find expression. No false strength. And again, as men, you know, I can't tell you how many times well-meaning friends, family, loved ones would give me a big old hug, squeeze me and say, be strong, Mike, be strong. And while I love them for their intention, it just saddens me that our Western culture's version of strength is to suck it up, to bury, suppress, and avoid those difficult feelings. Because the reality is, true strength is about having the courage to open up and actually feel the feelings, observe them, and learn from them what we can. You know, back to that, it was Carl Jung, he said, what was his quote? Until we make the unconscious conscious, it will direct your life and you will call it fate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same holds true for our emotional responses. Until we can be present to what we're feeling, those decisions that we make are always, again, there's a ton of research behind this. Look up Antonio Damasio, that we make decisions based on emotion, or emotion is at least the foundation for our decisions. And if we don't understand the underlying emotions that drive those decisions, we're screwed, because emotions drive decisions, decisions drive behaviors, behaviors drive results. And again, often we just try and address the behaviors, you know, the restraining order, which may work temporarily, but if we want long-term lasting change, we need to take a couple of steps back and address you know, not only the emotions, but okay, what's driving those emotions, the thoughts, the beliefs, the attitudes that we have that create those emotions, that ultimately create the decisions, that create the behaviors that drive our results.
I feel like for so long, and you know, I'm sure this is partly a function of the socialization that we're talking about, because for, you know, most of history, workplaces have been male dominated, right? This idea of like, you check your emotions at the door. We're not emotional here, right? Whereas like I worked for a high tech company where men would literally throw a temper tantrum and call themselves passionate. But if a woman shed a tear, it was like, oh, you're so emotional. We don't do emotions in the workplace, right? And so I think that, you know, when we talk about things like mental health and we talk about things like emotions, there's a recognition at some level that this is part of the human experience, that it's really important, but there's also still such a stigma attached to it. And I worry so much about just the social pressure to not even be vulnerable enough to have the kind of conversation that you're talking about. And I wonder, like, when you're working with men or you're having these conversations, do you have to kind of like hide the broccoli and the mashed potatoes, or do you actually come right out and say like, hey, we need to overtly start talking about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. That was kind of what I was getting at before. So to me, when I come at it from, you know, I was a high performing leader. So I sometimes get doors open for me that others might not. So if you've got the diversity, equity, and inclusion expert, you know, a female person of color that comes in, there's going to be an audience that will not hear them regardless of the message. So, you know, I'm a middle-aged white dude. I acknowledge that I've got some privilege. My opportunity is to use that privilege to reach others. So sometimes it is hiding the broccoli and the mashed potatoes. But I talk about the emotionally connected continuum. And my hope is that we can move guys up that continuum. So at the low end of the, you know, at the far extreme end of the continuum is Paul Jacob, the man that killed Colleen. And while I hope that most of your audience is not so far down the emotional connected continuum that they would take somebody else's life and their own, I can assure you all of us have some room to move up that continuum. You know, it's interesting because I often think about at what point in Paul Jacob's life and what kind of intervention might have made that difference. You know, maybe a kind word from a teacher. You know, how far back do we have to go that there would have been a decision that sort of did that 1% pivot that might have ultimately changed the trajectory of his life. And it drives me to realize that, you know, changes don't have to be big. They just have to be consistent and over time. So to answer your question, I will typically have a quick assessment of where I feel folks are on that continuum. And then I know how I need to talk to them. And again, my hope is that I can, you know, we start with the broccoli and the mashed potatoes, and then a few servings down the road, we start to pull the broccoli out so they can actually look, that was broccoli you ate. It was actually not so bad, was it? And by the way, there's a whole bunch of research that shows that broccoli is really healthy for you and good for you. You want to be healthy, don't you? Right. So it's kind of that whole, you know, I don't want to sort of oversimplify it, but yes, it's. Sometimes there's that, you know, I used to call it the Trojan horse. I'd have to, you know, I come in and I talk about, you want to sell more widgets? I can teach you how to sell more widgets. And oh, by the way, that competence that you need to sell more widgets, building that emotional connection with your customers, you can't do that if you don't have an emotional connection with self. And if I can get you to that emotional connection with self, which will then teach you to make that emotional connection with customers, which will then teach you to sell more widgets because that's really what you care about. That's why you came to me. That's why people will pay me because, you know, it improves their ROI. But at the same time, you know, the reason I'm passionate about teaching men in particular the art of emotional reconnection is emotionally connected men don't freaking kill people. Mm-hmm. Emotionally connected men make better leaders, they make better partners, they make better fathers, they live richer lives. And for me, this whole experience has been the difference of moving my life from black and white to full 4K color. The depth of experience that I can now have is mind-blowing to me. And that's my hope for every man, is to be able to get to that place. And again, not that I'm there. I've always got room to move up the continuum. And sometimes I slide back on that continuum. There's no question.
Well, and I think, you know, we tend to think of things in very, you know, sort of binary terms, right? We think of men as not emotional and women being super emotionally sophisticated. But there are many women who are have the opportunity to move up that continuum as well, right?
No question. Well, and I think that's one of the potential perils that we face in this race for equity and equality. Are we trying to condition the emotion out of women so they can be equal? Mm-hmm. Well, I hope not. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that we can, instead of doing that, we can condition the emotion back into men so we can become more equitable. I mean, again, that's oversimplified, but I think there is a risk of doing the same thing to women that we've done to men as a society, and that's problematic.
Yeah, and you know, I think you and I probably talked about this when we first talked too, but I think a lot about the fact that as a society, at least, you know, here in the US, I know it's not true in every part of the world, but at least here in the US, we have been updating for years the definition of what it means to be a woman in society. There is so much flexibility. Women have so many choices, whether it's stay home with your kids, work part-time, become a powerhouse executive, you know, come in and out of your career at different stages. And we have not really updated the definition of what it means to be a man in society. And so I feel like we are on this mission through diversity, equity, and inclusion to create more opportunities at top of an organization for women and other members of marginalized groups. But until we make it safe and respectable for men to walk away from those roles and do other things, right? Like we create this situation where we're asking them to be supportive of everyone around them, but we're not showing support to them in exchange. And so I wonder what your thoughts are on how if we want to bring men on this journey, we have to center them in the conversation to some extent too. It can't just be like, oh, everybody else is on this journey and men are kind of on the side. You have to be our allies, but you're not allowed to have your own experience in the process, right?
Yeah, and you're right. And that is a conversation I have often. And again, fully acknowledging the privilege I hold as a male. But let's not forget that privilege, the patriarchy, also comes with a price for men. And I think we need to talk about that more. We absolutely need to talk about that more. That's a hard one because there are so many people that don't want to have that conversation because you've had it so good for so long. And so we're not talking about you anymore. It's like, okay, but I get it. But do you want to be right or do you want to be effective?
Yes.
Because sometimes you can't be both. And I will choose being effective every single day over being right. So that's a very important conversation, but it's also interesting because, you know, I did a workshop for senior executive at a fairly high level firm here in Canada. And I proposed that we do something exclusive for their male leadership. And of course the immediate pushback was, whoa, hell no, we cannot do something exclusive for our dudes. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what. I said, you go interview all of the VP level and up females in your organization, and you ask them how they feel about if we were to do this thing exclusively for our men, again, knowing that it's centered on emotional connection, mental health for guys. You ask them what they feel or what they think about that, and I'll reconnect with you in a couple of weeks. So I reconnected in a couple of weeks, And this individual, it was a male that was I was talking to that we were talking about organizing this. He was blown away. He said, "Oh my God, Mike." He said, "You know what? I was shocked." He said, "Every single one of them, as soon as I brought it up, like I didn't even have to finish saying my sentence. They were like, hell yeah. Because if you take care of the men in our organization, so many of our other problems go away." So, and I think that gets lost, right? If we take care of, and again, to how you define take care of, if we create this, the space for men to become more emotionally connected to self, to others and community, a lot of our societal problems go away. A lot of them do.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important, the nuance, because there is so much attention being paid to what other, you know, even just the fact that you have repeatedly said you're aware of your privilege, right? I mentioned to you that I had been conducting a survey of men to ask them what's hard about being a man in the workplace today, because I don't think they generally get asked that question. And I really wanted to understand it as part of the context of what we're talking about here. And almost every single respondent answered that question with a, "Well, I know I don't have it as bad as other people, but," right? And because they've been conditioned to believe that their experience is not as important or not as bad, or, you know, and I'm not saying that there's, that we should be comparing. All I'm saying is that we have to treat every human as having a valid and legitimate experience. And that, you know, as long as people feel like they can't share their story or own their own experience, because that would in some way delegitimize the experience of someone else, then we aren't going to get to where we want to be.
Yeah, 100%. And again, that's the problem. So if you've got the sort of the extreme views or sort of, you know, problematic beliefs, attitudes that we want to get away from, if we don't create a space where somebody can actually articulate those views, then they just go underground and the behaviors don't change. The attitudes aren't visible. You know, again, I use the iceberg analogy all the time, right? What we see are the behaviors and we see the results. What we don't see are the decisions. We don't see the emotions. We don't see the thoughts, beliefs, and attitudes underneath that. And if all we do is wag our finger and shame the beliefs and attitudes, then I will just shut down and I'll pretend like I don't have those beliefs and attitudes, but my behaviors aren't going to change because I haven't been given the space to actually unpack the beliefs and attitudes that I have that ultimately, as we go up that iceberg, start to manifest in behaviors.
So is there something that you would recommend people listening think about doing in their own worlds? Like, I mean, so much of what I, you know, I go on this roller coaster ride all the time of, I see the opportunity and I get enthusiastic about it. And then I realize how expansive this problem is. And I get frustrated and lose my optimism. Like, what are the things that we can all do or think about to try to move us in the direction that we're talking about?
Well, I think the first thing is just to create the space for the men in your life. Create the space for yourself if you're a dude. So, you know, whether that's journaling, meditation, self-reflection, whatever you call it, just create that space. If you are somebody that loves a dude and you want to create that space, and I hear this often, my guy won't open up to me. He won't share with me. There's a couple of things going on there. I'm in the middle of writing an article about this that I think you need to understand is, A, it takes a hell of a lot of courage for us men to actually share what we're feeling. So we probably need a lot more space than you think we need. So when you ask me, you know, how are you feeling, or what's coming up with that? My immediate reaction is, it's fine. I'm fine. You can ask me a second time. It'll probably be the same. You know, it might take 10 times, and it's not just peppering me with questions, but, you know, my point is, it takes us a lot more space to get there typically than a lot of women that in my experience. So it takes a lot of courage for us to do that. So we need a lot of space to do that. The second piece is we're not very good at being able to articulate that because, again, we've had the emotion conditioned out of us. So if you're a dude and you want to get better at this, you know, building that emotional vocabulary is huge. I run a men's group every second Wednesday. And that was one of the exercises we did two meetings ago. We met last night. The meeting before, we took anger, fear, and sadness, and we brainstormed all different variations of each of those emotions. So we practiced building our emotional vocabulary. So that's the second challenge in getting change is we typically don't have a very strong emotional vocabulary. The third piece is we're also worried about your reaction to how we show up. And, you know, whether that's another man or whether it's a woman, it's hard because most of us aren't super good at holding space. You know, we either want to fix things or we want to ignore things. And so I've got to be concerned about your reaction when I do become vulnerable and I do disclose, because it's going to weird you out, because that's not what guys do. So I have to be concerned about your reaction. And maybe you won't love me as much because you do want the protector, the provider, the producer. And again, it doesn't mean I can't strive to do those things while still being vulnerable. But understand that when you ask me to be vulnerable, wow, that just hit me. Mm. It's a scary fucking thing, Kim. Mm. It's a really, really scary thing. And it takes a lot of courage to do that. It takes courage. I need to find the vocabulary and I need to be safe in knowing that your response to that, your reaction to that is not going to hurt me, harm me in any way. So, you know, the biggest thing for individuals, I think, is just to slow down and self-reflect. Take that time. For me, journaling is a big one. I don't write to document my thoughts. I write to discover my thoughts. So that's a big piece of it. Journaling for me is another one. Having conversations like this is another one. My men's group. You know, literally connected men, I've created a community. My mission is to create a community of emotionally connected leaders that inspire men to feel more so they can be more and ultimately do more. So I created a group called Connected Men. Again, we meet virtually every second Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. I've got an online community where we meet and we just talk about what's going on in life. And it's that practice of showing up. You know, we had a fellow last night share, I want to be cautious of confidentiality, but just some of the shares are just so incredibly powerful. And these are things that many of these guys have never said out loud ever anywhere. And there's a magic that happens when a group of dudes come together with intention. Mm.
And you know, as I was hearing you talk to, one of the things that struck me is that the emotion that all men are feeling in what you're describing is fear, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fear, and maybe that's not something they can name, but I just don't think that, and we see this in every aspect of society today, that when you have a population of people who are afraid and don't have the coping skills or the self-awareness to process that fear.
Or the space.
The space, yes, that. Exactly. And to really find the support that you need in other people, that bad things happen. And your story is just horrible. And, you know, I'm so sorry for everything that you've gone through. And I'm so grateful to you for the work that you're doing in response, because I think it is so incredibly important to all of us. And I just want to reiterate for, you know, much of my audience is female. And I just don't want this to feel like it's an either or proposition, right? That is a betrayal of the women's movement to want to support men.
Not in the slightest. Not in the slightest. I do a lot of speaking on, I get hired to come out and talk about men as allies. And almost always I lead with men. What you need to understand is women don't need our help. They just need us to take care of our own shit. and that's it. So yeah, so it's not at all about taking away from anybody else. It's just, again, we don't need to be the white knight. We don't need to be the savior. All we need to do is take care of our own shit. Women are fully more than capable, because you've been supporting our sorry backsides for a very long time in a lot of cases, especially that emotional support, right? And that's, you know, there was a piece in, I think it was in the Huffington Post a while back. I actually reached out to the author and spoke to her for a bit. And the title of the article was something to the effect of, men have no friends and women pay the price. And it was just, it was a very powerful look at, again, for most of us, and I'll speak for me, most of my life, my only emotional support was my partner. Mm. And so when that's the only place, the only thing you've got, that can be challenging. I mean, that's a lot of weight to carry. And so I think, again, getting out, creating those other spaces where guys can connect with one another and don't have to, you know, have the big pissing contest, and we can actually just drop the stereotypical masculine bullshit and just get real for a few minutes. Mm. Like that's huge.
Yeah. That's my vision too. I really am. I'm grateful that you're on this mission, and I'm wholeheartedly supportive.
and sorry, just to go back to your point about, you know, you're sorry for my loss. I want to be clear that this is a powerful story, yes, but this isn't a story about loss. This is a story of hope. Mm. And I think that's important. And that's, you know, what I always try and bring it back around to. I, you know, you can see me, I tear up all the time telling these. But at the end of the day, I tear up because I'm hopeful, not because I'm destroyed or sad, or, I mean, there's a sadness in there for sure, but it's hope that gets me emotional.
What a powerful way for us to wrap up this conversation today. And I will say to those of you out there listening, if you have brothers, partners, friends, colleagues, anybody that you think could benefit, who can't, right, from this conversation, please, please help us share it. And Mike, thank you so much. I know you mentioned places where you are and where people can find you. All of those links will be in the show notes as well for anybody who's interested in following up with you directly. And thank you again for such an important conversation.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the Imposter Syndrome Files. If you would like to continue this conversation in a safe and trusted space, I would love for you to join my virtual discussion group every Thursday at 12 p.m. Eastern. For the past several years, the group has been limited to women, but it is now open, regardless of gender, to anyone who is interested in exploring and troubleshooting common workplace challenges, building better awareness of ourselves and others, and becoming more inclusive allies at work. Check out the show notes for more info on how to find us, and please join us next week for another episode of the Imposter Syndrome Files.